Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast where athletes, Olympians and sports people, past and present, talk about the challenges they face or faced over the course of their careers. I'm Mark Clement, alongside me Scott Ward, one of four footballing brothers and a man who spent more than a decade working on the content that now makes up EY's personal performance programme, Building a Better Working World, and indeed this podcast. And joining us for this episode, a former footballer who played over 500 professional games, including three times reaching Wembley Cup finals with Crystal Palace and Sheffield Wednesday and helping Palace and Charlton Athletic to promotion. He's currently head of Crystal Palace's under-23s development squad and their loan manager. Mark Bright has a critically acclaimed biography out, My Story from Foster Care to Footballer. And I'm going to read you just a little bit of the synopsis. This book is not just about his time in the game. It's the story of someone who battled against the odds to achieve his dream. It's the story of a boy coping with the bewildering and frightening circumstances of being taken into care with his brother when they were both very young. It's the story of his fractured family with a father who arrived in England from the Gambia, met a girl from Stoke-on-Trent, and then very quickly disappeared from his children's lives. Brighty, why haven't we heard this story before?
I think there just comes a time when you feel it's your time to tell your story. It was always about the football for me. I didn't want anyone to feel sorry for me. There'll be people in far worse positions than me who've had far worse starts in life. Lots of the African footballers, etc. Lots of players coming from single-parent families, battling their way through, mums trying to scrape and help their kids to make it on the ladder. So I just didn't feel it justified being told until I reached this age where we look at Cyril Regis, Larry Cunningham, Ugo Ekiog, J-Lug Samuel, Daley Atkinson, to mention a few who've died too early. And you just think, right, comes a time now, my son's getting older, where you can do something, produce something which will be there forever. So I only intended to do one book, so when the opportunity arose, then I just thought, you know what, I feel the time's right.
You'd never shared this. I mean, not, no, have you shared
close,
it with teammates? Would
close
Wrighty
people,
have known?
Yeah, right.
Steve Parrish would know.
Steve knew some. You know, I remember we were away one time. And there was we were on holiday, and there was a few of Steve's mates. Steve had a boat, and we'd just sitting there. I think it was one night. Just had something to eat and this and the other. And then he just said, "What's your backstory?" to one or two the other guys. And I just skipped bits of mine and just came into the football sort of thing. But he knows a little bit through travel. We've travelled together every away game and that sort of thing. We talk and chat. So some players are aware, not many. Not many.
It's very brave of you because we kind of, we form judgments about people without really knowing the true extent of how
they
got to where
they are. We watch the TV and we form a judgment on somebody who we don't know anything about them. And, you know, there's those sayings, isn't there? You know, be careful what you say to people. You don't know what where they are in life. So, you know, you go and say to somebody, let me just give you this idea, Clem. I think it's Regent Street. It's in the middle of the afternoon. It's the summer. I've got a pair of shorts on, probably a T-shirt. I can't remember what I'm doing, but I'm crossing the road. I get to the centre reservation and a guy with post office outfit on, with like a bit of a sack or something, shouts, Brighty, so you know what it's like. You kind of turn and you look and you just wave. He went, come on, look at the size of you. I saw Wrighty the other day, he looked slim. I saw Ferdy, he looked slim. Come on. Just everybody around starts laughing at me. I'm just standing there going, cheers, mate.
Thanks, mate.
But wait, you know what I mean? But like, he doesn't know where I am. He doesn't know what's happened to me. But this is the things we all do and say. So, you know, it made me think, though. Maybe Trump, you know what, he's right. I've got to put too much weight on. I've got to lose some weight here. So, you know, we do all these things all the time. So anyway, basically, I felt the time was right for me to say something. The opportunity came to write the book. The right person came along, a guy called Kevin Brennan, who I've known for 30 years. He's known me since I joined Crystal Palace, used to interview me for the South London Press. You know what it's like when you talk to somebody you know and trust, you're very relaxed. So he would say, Bright, I want to talk these three subjects in a couple of days. Start doing a bit of research or have a think or phone your brother or your sisters. You know, they're the things I want to talk about. And the rest of the information came from our social service files. So when you're in care, there's a log. everything's locked. People come to see you after school, they turn up, how are you? And you're thinking, who's this? I'm from the social services, I just come check you're okay, is everything okay at school? It's all logged, dates, everything. So you get these files and they kind of put their hands on the files and say to you, right, there's language using these files that was used in like, it's the early 60s and 70s and it's not acceptable. And we know that, but this is the language they use now. So please, when you read it, just bear that in mind. So you kind of wonder, you know, it's like that. You wonder, where's that going? And then you read through them and you just see certain things and you learn things. So it said...
This is recently, sorry.
This is... God.
You've just
I got my files.
Yeah.
Within the last 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Like my brother and me sent for them. The reason being, I'm coming out of the toilets at Wembley. I think it's an FA Cup final. I'm invited guest. Neil Morris is going in. So you know what it's like. You see someone, you think you know them. So you nod at each other, and he goes, first of all, I see him, and I thought, oh, Christ, Neil Morrissey. And then he sees me, he goes, Brighty, Christ almighty, stay where you are. You're the reason I support Crystal Palace, you and Wrighty. And I go a bit goose pimply, and everyone's around, and he just goes, plus I was in the same care home as you. That made me get my legs went wobbly. Because no one's ever said it to me, no one. So he comes out the toilets, and he bombards me with all this information. You know what he's like. Give me a number. And we're like obviously quite good friends now. So he says he's doing a documentary. He's trying to find 5 or 6 people from that care home and see where they are in their lives and see how it shaped them and everything. And he asked me to, would you want to take part? And I said, no, because my mum was alive at the time and my sisters grew up with my mum. So I said, no. And that changed us. As soon as that document out, my brother phoned me at the end. He said, I want my social services records. How do I get them? Ask Neil how you get them. And we sent for them and we went to go and collect them. And then that is some harrowing reading right there.
Brought it all back. Emotional experience going through the file?
Very, very, yeah. Because you read everything and they tell you. And it said that the start of the story basically was mum and dad were together. They had Marie, Philip and myself. And they separated. Dad moved out, went across to Stoke. My mum lived in Bucknell, which is, say, 3 or 4 miles. Mum takes us over to Dad, says, I've got to go to a wedding tomorrow. Can you have the kids? I'll come and collect them Sunday. Yeah, okay. She goes to the wedding. Sunday morning, nothing. Sunday afternoon, nothing. Late Sunday afternoon, Dad takes us over to our mum's house. Note pinned on the door. I've had my goat short, turn them off. Wow. So there's you. So from there... I think Garth Crooks' mum looks after us for a little bit, tries to keep the whole thing together. Then she's can't do it. So I remember doing the research of the book and asked Garth, could he speak to his uncle? His mum's passed away. Could he speak to your uncle or anybody who would know something? Old people don't like to talk. So what they know, they didn't want to share. So they said no. He said no, they would. So I couldn't get anything from there. So... We got taken into care because you can't look after, our dad couldn't look after 3 kids and work. So into care we go, then we get fostered out. And then we last sort of about 5 years with Nana Parton. And we go back to the children's home and then we go to our real Nan who tries then to pull the family together because we're in the same vicinity. And that doesn't work. Then we go back and then get fostered out to the Davises, Gran and Grandad Davies, who we stay with for over 10 years. So... There's a lot of, I can imagine I've done so many interviews, right? So I talk to Kevin, who's the journalist, who then stitches the whole thing together. Mm. With the publishers, we went and had meetings with them and they said, right, we want private, the life here and the career here running parallel, which I think, I kind of wanted the football side of things. I was a bit cautious about doing the life side because I thought, I don't know if people are they gonna really enjoy that. So
were you embarrassed by it?
No, not at all. Just
were you embarrassed my brother, back in the day? Were you embarrassed back during your football
career?
No, it was
No, because no one knew. Mm. And plus we were a black family, two black kids with a white family. So we knew something was wrong. But we didn't ask questions. And you know, the interviews I've done for this, when obviously you get the rough draft and you read through it and kind of like you come to the end and go, my God, wow. I mean, I think I know I'm a bit biased, but Kevin, it's difficult because sometimes if phone me, I'd say, oh, do you know what, Kev? I missed this bit out. Such and such told me that, right. So he'd go, wait, right. So is this after you were at Nana Clark's or before you were at Nana Parton's or where were you? Yeah, we were, you know, and it's just chasing your tail. He'd phone me up and say, Mark, I need to be clear on this because I've got to through this chronological order. Where did you go after here? Did you say anything? Did they say anything? So, I mean, have you seen a copy of it?
No, not yet.
You haven't had a read. Okay, so it's that's the start of the book virtually, and also, you know, people say, I know I've come out of it okay. The whole family, the three sisters are great, my brother's great. We've all got families. Everybody's fine, you know, and no damage done really, but been traumatic in between. Mm. No sister-brother relationships really, fragmented. And then my brother came home one Friday. We shared a flat together. I was in bed because I was playing the next day for Port Vale and that. And he came home at 2 o'clock in the morning, had a few scoops. And he said, I met Marie in the place. It was a nightclub in Stoke. And I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, we've got to get back together. We've got to start seeing each other again. This is madness. So we tried to work out, I think it's 7 years when we didn't see them at all. Don't know why, I just didn't. They were in a totally different part of Stoke. So then we kind of pulled together and then started to be part of each other's lives and everything. It's just unbelievable how it's all come back round.
I'll tell you why I asked the question, were you embarrassed? Because I wondered whether when your career started to take off, you saw it as a stick that people might have beaten you with.
No.
As opposed to in the modern era.
Do you know what? It's amazing how
it would probably be talked about and brought out in the dressing room and things.
Because information comes from, say it's Wikipedia. The more interviews you do and the more you say, the more information's available. Somebody attaches it to your Wikipedia page. So it kind of just said Mark Bright, born in Stoke-on-Trent, you know, Leek Town, Port Vale, Leicester. So if you Googled or whatever, you'd just only see that. So I never discussed my upbringing or my private life much at all. Kind of tried to stay away from that. Any interviews you do just keep to a bare minimum of information you give out. As you know, he comes back to haunt you sometimes, or people just... My brother always said, you know, John and Justin fashion you. My brother always said, everybody knows about them, the Bernardo's boys. There was lots of footage of them going back to the old white couple in Norwich and chatting and, you know, and I thought that was great. And I did. I didn't sort of say, I want that to be me. I kind of thought, I don't want that to be me. I want to be known as Mark Bright, played football, and then at the end of it, it wasn't an easy start in my life, but it's not an easy start for anybody else's life. But this is my story from beginning to, and I kind of sometimes come. You think, I wonder if everyone goes, oh my God, he feels sorry for himself, because I've always stated when I go and start doing an interview, I don't want it. The intention is not for anybody to feel sorry for me whatsoever. I'm not like that. I'm a glass half full person. I've made the best, got dealt some cards, done the best with them. And I look at our family, how we've all come out, and I'm really proud of everybody.
I mean, I bring it up because I actually had a similar experience with Callum Wilson. If my memory serves me right, he's one of six, and he went into foster care. But now at a football club, you will have, say, Eddie Howe getting the boys together to tell your backstory. And I guess what it does is it engenders empathy.
Is that what he does?
He does. So he'll have like a big open forum, and they all tell your stories.
Wow.
So let's say he's having a bad day. This is Callum. Then there might be a bit more empathy for him from those who know where he's come from, his journey.
I'm not sure that...
happens in the changing room, does it?
Yeah, I think...
not in the changing room necessarily, but we'll have specific meeting sections where they share their backstories.
I think Bournemouth is a very unique club. So obviously Elliot played there, and Eddie and the club have remained... Don't get me wrong, they've changed dramatically over the last few years, but the culture of the club has remained the same. It's still Bournemouth, League Two, not trying to get relegated, let's all fight together. I think in reality... 99.9% of clubs away from there probably would find that a real struggle, because there's always that disconnect between the first team, the reserves, the 23s, the scholars, the academy. And then, of course, like we've spoken to managers about before, trying to ensure that they keep their job is paramount, and therefore what do they need to do to win the game on the Saturday or the Tuesday or the Wednesday? So I think what Eddie's done is quite unique, and he can afford that because of the environment that he works in. I think
he calls it storytelling, and they take it in turns to tell the rest of the squad backstory.
Listen, that depends on the person. It's like an AA meeting, isn't it? Yeah. You stand up and you bare your soul. And not everybody wants to do that in a football club.
That's right.
You definitely... I didn't speak about mine. Nobody knew. The players in Port Vale didn't know. Robbie Earle knew, because Robbie Earle's like my oldest friend in football. But Robbie wouldn't say nothing. So if the manager said, Brighty, tomorrow you can hear your back... I doubt that, mate. I'm not stand up talk. Because... Not because you're ashamed, because you don't feel it, you don't want it. You're at this football club and you're trying to perform at your best every week. You give your all. Why does everyone need to be involved in my backstory? And is it important for me to tell? If I say to the manager, do you know what? I totally respect what you're doing with the team. I like it. I like sitting listening. I'm not prepared to talk about my background. I'd say that. I don't want to fall out over it, but you just say, Gaffer, I don't want to talk about my background, honestly. And then he thinks something was wrong. Why? Because everyone does it, Mark. It'll open it up. Everyone, what? One day, if I come in and I'm not training very well, I will say, don't shout, Brighty. Because he didn't have one dad when he was growing up. That's not going to happen. not when I was brought up in. It was tough at our place, Palace. It was brutal. Yeah. It's not something I can see where you say, is it something you're slightly embarrassed about and you kind of tended not to talk about? I just steered away from it because I didn't feel it was relevant for me being a football player and where I come from. If you see some of these stories, those 30-minute stories in America for some of the basketball players and this, that and the other, I mean, shoot, best friend shot when they were 16, da-da-da-da, knifed, chased down. Horrendous stories. Horrendous. Now, I think they just shrug their shoulders and say that's where they grew up.
Yeah, and this is this is very selfless of you. All right, then. Did it play a part in motivating you? You know, if people actually lose a parent, they're usually high achievers. So much of an influence was it on your career, on proving yourself?
Right, so Neil Morrissey had he said he thinks because we were denied when we were younger, it made us more driven. And I said, right, so you're saying anybody in care was more driven than people who were brought up with their families? Not true. Simply not true. Otherwise, you'd have like a series of successful people. But there was a whole list of people, you know, from Roman Abramovich to Bruce Oldfield to Chris Akabusi, you know, a whole load of sports athletes and that who were in care. And they've all been successful. I had a whole list when I went to do a few interviews. There's a whole list of people who you wouldn't know were in care and have been successful. But also, other people are successful. What gives you your work ethic? What gives you your drive? You can have five kids, two of them can be really driven and the other three not driven. Just take on different genes. So it's, you know...
And you'll see that in your work at the moment as well, won't you? You have to deal with a group of kids who you're having to manage that.
You try and encourage them more than anything. My job at the club is not to bring anyone down or to slag anybody off or point a finger and say you should have scored or you should have got clear of that. It's not that job. The job's to try and improve the kids. Get them a career. If it's not at Crystal Palace, somewhere in football, because we see that as part of our. We've developed that player, and he's still in the game. So I try and stay in touch with all the players who've left: Keshi Anderson, Hiram Boateng, Freddie Ladapo,
all these guys. Yeah, they've gone on to have Sully Kaikai,
Johnny
careers.
Williams. Yeah, and you know, you text when you see them in the play, they score. Yeah. You know, you text. It's part of just being a human being. Yeah. You know, aftercare is. You know, I think Steve enjoys that you actually. So Steve's thing is we take these kids in from 8 and we give them hopes and aspirations of playing in the Premier League, and then at 16 or 18 we cut them, because we have to make a decision. We sit around a table and we have a piece of paper in front of people's pictures on, and we say, right, do we think this guy can play for Crystal Palace Football Club? If not now, next year or the year after, or do we think he's going to be good enough for us? And you have to make decisions. When I had to do that, Clem, when Alan Pardew said to me, you're sitting in that meeting tomorrow and you're part of that process, I never slept the night before. Yeah. Never slept, because I've got to tell somebody, be part of the group, three people, to tell that player, we don't think you're going to be good enough to play for Crystal Palace. However, that shouldn't stop you from continuing your journey. Ian Wright, Vinnie Jones, Les Ferdinand, a whole load more players have gone non-league and they've bounced back and gone to the league. So you have to try and explain this to them. At that moment in time, they can't hear you. Their head is just falling off because they've heard something they never thought they were going to hear. You're not going to be good enough. So that's a hard part. I've had it myself. I thought I was getting an apprenticeship at Port Vale. Didn't get it. Had to go and get a job. knocked me back a little bit because my plan was
to play
hydraulic engineering. Yeah, I did a year full-time at college, then 2 years part-time.
Hydraulic engineer.
Yeah, Staff's Hydraulic Services at Kidsgrove. We made parts for oil rigs and pipelines. The oil gets piped back, yeah, and they have to tighten the bolts up all to the same pressure underneath. And we made the hydraulic tool that does that, tightens them all up to the divers go down and seal them all up and that sort of thing. So we did all that sort of stuff.
Told by the man himself, you're listening to the stories that have shaped the life and career of former footballer Mark Bright, a conversation that, let's be honest, was never going to fit into one episode, so we're going to make this a two-parter. Thanks then for the time being to Mark and to Scott, and to you for listening. Many more big names to come from a huge range of athletes, sports people, and indeed sports in future episodes. For more information about the programme itself, please visit our website. That's ey.com/UK/personal-performance-programme. This podcast and future podcasts in the Blood, Sweat and Fear series are on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, building a better working world. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye for now. Listen out for part 2.